Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We take your phone calls for an hour without commercial breaks so that we can get as many calls in as possible. Sometimes that number is limited by the verbosity of the host in responding to phone calls, but we do try to get as many callers through as we can in an hour. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, that's what we invite you to call about. Or if you have a different viewpoint from the host and think that the comment needs to be balanced more by your insights, feel free to give me a call. The number is 844-484-5737. Right now I'm looking at a switchboard that's only about half full, which means that you can get through right now if you call right now. The number is 844-484-5737. I have an announcement to make about tonight. We have our monthly Zoom meeting tonight. It's always on the first Wednesday of the month, and it's at 7 o'clock p.m. Pacific time. At 7 p.m. Pacific time. We welcome you to join us for that if you're free. It's an hour and a half or two, depending on how many questions there are. But it's Q&A, just like this show is, only, of course, it's on Zoom, which means we get to look each other in the face while we talk to each other, which is always my preference since radio doesn't afford me that opportunity to see who I'm talking to. So once a month, we have this Zoom meeting on Wednesday night, first Wednesday of the month. If you want to join us and you don't know how to do that, just go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. That is thenarrowpath.com. There's a tab there that says announcements, and under today's date, the announcement is Zoom meeting, 7 p.m. Pacific time, and it'll show you where, how to log in. You know, if you've never been on Zoom before, you have to kind of go to a Zoom website, then you have to log in a code for the meeting. And those that information is listed there at thenarrowpath.com under announcements. All right, well, we're going to talk to Paul, who's calling us from Colorado, first of all, today. Hi, Paul. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Say, I was wondering, I've heard you quote 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 10 in reference to when tongues will cease. And I noticed something there was pointed out to me years ago that I think is valid, is that he never mentions tongues there as being in part. He mentions that prophecy and knowledge is in part, but tongues is not mentioned as being in part. And then he says, when that which is perfect is come, that which is in part shall be done away. But he never mentions that tongues is in part. He just kind of throws it in there with the rest of it. And he does use different words for the, when tongues cease and when the prophecy and the knowledge, vanishes away, you know. So I just wanted to get your comments on that.
Sure. Well, the only time I would ever talk about 1 Corinthians 13 in connection with tongues ceasing is when I'm responding to the arguments of somebody who says that tongues ceased. And they usually use this verse where Paul says, when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part will be done away. Now, that which is in part, of course, Paul mentions that our knowledge is in part, our prophesying is in part. And the assumption would be, and perhaps, you know, perhaps you're questioning that assumption, and you can certainly do so, but the assumption is that when Paul talks about knowledge and prophecy in this context, he's talking about the gifts in general. And there are people who believe that the gifts ceased when the apostolic age ended. And they often will use this passage. I don't agree with them. I don't think this passage says any such thing. I don't believe that the gifts have ceased, and I don't believe this is saying that they would at the end of the apostolic age. What Paul says is we currently are doing these things in a partial way, not a complete or perfect way. And when that which is perfect has come, then this partial way will be done away. In fact, he goes on to say, when I was a child, I spoke and acted and thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. This seems to be an illustration of what he means by that which is in part will be done away when that which is perfect or mature has come. When I was a child, I did things in a childish way, including thinking and speaking and acting in a childish way. But when I became a man, I don't do those things in a childish way anymore, but I still do them. I still act, I still think, and I still talk. I just don't do it in the childish way I used to do it in when I was a child. So Paul seems to be saying that the Corinthians, perhaps, and maybe all Christians at this point, have an imperfection in their gifts, in the function of their gifts. But that can be remedied when that which is mature, the word perfect can be translated mature, has come. And I think that in this context, maturity refers to doing these things out of love rather than out of self-aggrandization. Because this is a chapter about love. And he begins it, he ends the previous chapter by saying, earnestly desire the best gifts, and yet I show you a more excellent way. And then he goes to chapter 13, starts talking about love. Now, it's interesting, he says, desire the best gifts. And he doesn't change his mind about that, because in chapter 14, after he's talked about chapter 13, he says, pursue love and desire spiritual gifts, especially that you may prophesy. So, in other words, he goes into chapter 13 saying, we should desire the best gifts. And after he's finished chapter 13, he says the same thing again, desire spiritual gifts, especially that you may prophesy. So what is 13 talking about? It's not talking about something instead of gifts. It's talking about a more excellent way. Interesting, he says, desire spiritual gifts, but he doesn't say, but I will show you a more excellent situation where there are no gifts, but rather, I'll show you a more excellent way in which to behave, including in the exercise of your gifts. That love is that which should dictate all that you do, not excluding your gifts. And now, the Corinthians were, in fact, very immature. He told them that. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, he told them, when I was with you, I couldn't treat you as mature people. You were carnal and like babes. You're immature. And we see one of the evidences of their immaturity is in the way that they apparently used the gifts of the Spirit that they had in such a way as to draw attention to themselves or to promote their own importance, to dominate. And those are not loving things to do. Those are selfish things to do. He actually says in chapter 14 that whatever your gift may be, you should do it to edify other people. That's the main thing. He said if you want to speak in tongues in the church, it's not going to edify anybody unless there's an interpretation. And if there's not someone there to interpret, then just don't do it. Just speak to yourself and to God, but don't speak out in the church. Why? Because it won't edify anybody else but you. The point here is love is the more excellent way to live, including the more excellent way to manifest gifts. So he says, we prophesy in part, we know in part. I think what he means is we are immature at this stage. At least the Corinthians certainly are. He's already said that earlier. But when that which is mature comes, then the immature will go by the wayside and will be, replaced by the mature. But the mature would seemingly be the mature usage of these gifts as opposed to the immature usage, since he compares it with, I was a child, I spoke, acted, and thought as a child, but now I don't do that. I don't speak and act as a child. I do it like a man now. That's when that which is mature has come. The childish goes away. So that's how I understand it. You're right. He doesn't mention tongues in a few of the verses, but those who believe that the gifts have ceased believe that tongues is among the gifts that have ceased. Now, of course, when they talk about this passage, they don't interpret it the way I just explained. They basically say, well, Paul was anticipating something perfect coming, and once there's something perfect, you don't need stuff like gifts of the Spirit. Those are just for the imperfect time we live in, or that they were living in. And then, of course, it becomes incumbent on us to ask, well, what's he referring to? And he says that which is perfect. Now, of course, many Christians, and I think with good reason, would say, well, that which is perfect is Jesus. And therefore, when he comes back, we won't need the gifts of the Spirit. And this would be agreeable enough with 1 Corinthians 1:7, where Paul said, you will lack in no gifts while you're waiting for the revelation of Jesus Christ. In other words, as long as Jesus hasn't come yet and you're still waiting for him, you won't lack the gifts of the Spirit. That's strongly. The gifts will disappear. It'll be when Jesus comes back, not any time prior. Though I'm not sure that he's even saying that here. He could be. He could be also saying what I said, that, you know, when maturity comes, then immaturity will be put aside and be replaced by mature forms, which means loving forms of behavior. Now, but the cessationist is the one who thinks the gifts have ceased. They don't believe there's prophecy and tongues and healings and miracles anymore. They believe all that ended after the apostolic age. So what do they do with this? Well, when that which is perfect has come, these other things will be done away, Paul says. And they say, well, what Paul means when he says that which is perfect is he means the completed New Testament, which was not finished being written yet when he wrote this. So he's anticipating the time when the whole New Testament would be complete, and that would replace any need for the gifts of the Spirit, so they'd be taken away at that time. Well, that becomes, first of all, that suggests that Paul knew there was going to be a completed canon of the New Testament, which he never indicates that he knows this. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. And if he did, it also suggests that his readers know this because he doesn't tell them what he's talking about. He must assume that his words are understandable without any further explanation. So if he's talking about a complete canon of the New Testament writings, he must be assuming his readers intuitively know there's going to be such a thing. But how would they know that? I don't even think Paul knew that. And then, of course, you've got the real question is, when was the New Testament completed? We might say, well, when the last book of the New Testament was written, the book of John or the book of Revelation, whichever one you take last, then that was it was there. Well, it was there, but not all the Christians had it. It wasn't put together into a canon such as we know of New Testament writings until almost 400 A.D. It was actually 397 A.D. that I think it was the Council of Carthage finalized the canon. So, I mean, there'd be like 400 years where even though the New Testament was completely written, it wasn't decided on what books belonged to it yet. I mean, this makes it very obscure as to, well, when are we supposed to pinpoint the time when that which is perfect has come? Anyway, I would say that he's not talking about the coming of the New Testament because the New Testament has been completed for about, for many centuries, and yet we still know in part, and we still prophesy in part. And Paul said, when that which is perfect has come, then we will know even as also we are known, and we will see face to face rather than through a glass darkly. And that hasn't happened yet. So anyway, I think people who have a doctrine to prove, which is basically a hopeless doctrine because it's unscriptural, they have to be very desperate about importing ideas into passages, and that is certainly one of them. I'm not sure. We have talked about that before, as you say, but I have never used that passage to argue for the cessation of the gifts. Thank you for your call. Ken from Michigan, welcome.
Hi, Steve. My question is going to be a part of what the last guy was just asking you about there. I have a friend of mine that I've been Zooming with in a men's Zoom group for a few years now. He has a testimony about how he got baptized with the Holy Spirit and spoke in tongues in 74, and he's very confident of that. And he's recently, he's gotten involved with some full preterists, corresponding with them, listening to a lot of their teachings, and he just told me here within the past week that this passage in 1 Corinthians 13, his full preterist friends are telling him, like a cessationist would say, that all happened around that time of 70 A.D., and it was all tied in with the destruction of the of Jerusalem, and they incorporated into their full preterism.
I know. Full preterists believe that everything happened by 70 A.D. I mean, Satan was thrown into the lake of fire. He's not around anymore. That happened. The new heavens, the new earth came. That happened in 70 A.D., the resurrection of the dead happened. The final judgment happened. Of course, the gifts ceased.
Right.
They don't. Yeah. So I mean, that's what they, I mean. They think that 70 AD was the second coming of Christ. I don't know if you're aware, but I wrote a book against full preterism. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
Okay. So anyway, and I interact with primarily Don Preston, but some other full preterists on that. But yeah, I just don't think they're right. I mean, they have a shoehorn, and the shoe is AD 70, and they have to take any scripture, no matter what size or shape it is, and shoehorn it into that shoe. They have to force it into that shoe. And you know, sometimes they can make a pretty interesting case. Other times they're just out there hanging. They're just out there hanging in midair with only their assertions behind them. And
okay.
Yeah.
So you were aware of the connection between full preterism and cessationism. I never made that connection until this past week.
Well, full preterists certainly are cessationists, but they didn't invent it. Cessationism was probably invented by John Calvin. I mean, when you try to go back and find the first teacher who thought that the gifts of the Spirit ceased at the end of the apostolic age, Calvin taught that, but Luther, a generation earlier, didn't. So, and certainly the Catholics before Luther did not. So the church fathers in the first several centuries, they often mentioned prophets in their midst and healings and other gifts. I mean, they had never heard of any doctrine that those things had ceased. They just talked about them like, of course, as if the gifts just continued into their century and into their churches. The Catholic Church never renounced the gifts. Luther didn't. Luther believed in the gifts of the Spirit for today. I don't know what he thought about tongues, but he certainly believed that the gifts of the Spirit have not ceased. Calvin, who was a generation later than Luther, the second generation of the Reformation, seems to have invented. If he didn't, we don't know who did, but he seems to have invented the cessationist doctrine. Now, he was not a full preterist, but full preterists are not Calvinists. But cessationism, the cessation of the gifts, is a common doctrine between full preterists, who are usually not Calvinists, though there are Reformed full preterists now. They didn't used to be. It used to be that the full preterist movement rose in the Church of Christ, which is not Calvinist. But it spread far beyond the Church of Christ, and now there are Reformed full preterists, too. But the full preterist belief in cessationism is not necessarily dependent upon or directly related to that of Calvin or cessationists generally, because Calvin didn't believe that Jesus came back in 70 A.D. In fact, nobody believed that really until about 1970-something when Max King came up with that idea. There were others before Max King, before the 1970s, like in the late 1800s. There were people like James Stuart Russell and some others, Milton Terry, who they believed that most of the scriptures about the second coming, that is most of the scriptures that you and I would take of the second coming, they believed most of them were fulfilled in 70 AD. But they weren't full preterists who believed that all scriptures were fulfilled then. And as far as
I've read Russell, and I thought he was a full preterist, but okay.
Well, yeah, most full preterists call him a full preterist, but he didn't believe that Revelation 20 has already been fulfilled. That's the only exception he allowed. He believed that the 1,000 years between the binding of Satan and the new heavens and new earth, he said that that's the one passage that he does not believe can reasonably be fit into that paradigm. See, full preterists believe that the 1,000-year millennium is the 40 years between Christ's death and the fall of Jerusalem, which is, to my mind, quite absurd. I mean, that the Holy Spirit would use 1,000 years to represent a 40-year period. Russell thought that was undoable. And so in that respect, he was not a full preterist. But he is otherwise seemingly a full preterist, except for that one passage.
Okay.
All right?
Yep. Thanks.
All right. Hey, thank you for your call. Good talking to you. Carrie from Texas, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Steve, it's been a while since I've read your book on the four views of Revelation. And my pastor says he's going to be teaching on end times here in the near future. and I wanted to recommend your book to him. But I also wanted to be able to maybe plug in some of the different groups into the four different views that you have here. I assume that the dispensationalists would fall into the futurists.
Yes, yes.
View.
Yes.
They're not
the only futurists. There are futurists who are not dispensational, but the view you're most likely to hear among futurists these days would be the dispensational view.
So would all premillennialists be called futurists?
Generally, yes. Yeah.
And if you were a historic premillennialist, are you picking and choosing between the different
views
then?
That's a good point, because William Mounts was a historic premillennialist. Of course, George Eldon Ladd was a historic premillennialist, and they were kind of futurists. In their commentaries on Revelation, they kind of took a futurist approach. In fact, one commentator said the way to know whether to call someone a futurist or not is if they believe there's going to be a future Antichrist. And so if that really is the way to know if someone's a futurist or not, then Mounts and Ladd were both futurists. And yet they took some passages in more of an idealist way, and some maybe even a little bit in a preterist way, not much, but I would say they were more of a combination of idealist and futurist. But generally speaking, if somebody is a premillennialist of any kind, they are saying that the millennium is in the future, and for that reason, they normally would be futurists about the book.
And then as far as all millennial, are you picking and choosing aspects?
Yes. A premillennialist or a postmillennialist would not generally be a futurist, although there's nothing that would make it impossible for them to be. There's one famous Dutch theologian some centuries back who is an amillennialist and a futurist. That's very unusual. It's the only case I know of. Usually a futurist is going to be premillennial, and a premillennialist is going to be futurist. Now, if you're amillennial or postmillennial, you could be a historicist or an idealist or a preterist. For example, Luther and Calvin were amillennial, but they were historicist in their approach to Revelation. They weren't preterist, and they weren't futurist, and they weren't idealist. On the other hand, the first amillennialist I ever read was an idealist, and many, many of them are. What I'm saying is this. The view you take of the millennium is almost entirely independent of what you think about the rest of the book of Revelation, because the millennium stands out. It's only mentioned in one chapter near the end of the book, and its meaning is somewhat interpreted by its internal factors in that chapter. Now, the most of the book of Revelation, especially chapters 6 through 19, are mostly about what we call the tribulation. And the four views of Revelation are principally four views about when the tribulation is or what it is. So the futurist believes there's a future tribulation. A preterist believes the tribulation was in the past. The historicist and the idealist, in different ways, apply the whole tribulation to the whole age of the church. So, in other words, if someone says, I'm an idealist, they're talking about the portion of Revelation that's about the tribulation. If they say they're a historicist, that's what they're talking about too. Or preterist or futurist. But when you get to Revelation 20, you're not in the tribulation anymore. You've got the millennium there. And so people's views of the millennium, you can take any view of the millennium you want to and still hold any of the views of the tribulation that you want to. They're not joined at the hip in such a way as to be determinative.
Well, okay, I found it a little confusing.
I guess.
I
think we confused a whole bunch of listeners.
Came up with a Bible teacher who was a historic premillennialist.
Uh-huh.
And basically he said, my view is I'm all millennial until it comes to the millennium.
That's kind of that's what George Eldon Ladd said, too. Yeah, George Eldon Ladd was a very famous historic premillennialist. And he argued most of the Bible prophecy and most of the Bible like an amillennialist does. But he said the reason I'm not an amillennialist is because of Revelation 20, which he said I cannot see that in the amillennial way. He took it as a premillennial. So anyway, let me just say to our listeners who've been confused, because a lot of you have never heard these terms before, I wrote a book called Four Views of Revelation, which kind of makes those things, I think, clearer. But it also makes it confusing, because you find out there's really good reasons for different people to see the book of Revelation through different lenses. But my position is, it doesn't matter which view you take. You don't need to understand the book of Revelation in order to be saved or a disciple of Jesus. It's an interesting study, and I don't want to discourage that study. But even if you never decide what Revelation is about, you can still be a great Christian, and don't worry about it. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We have to take a break. And our website is thenarrowpath.com. Stay tuned. I'll be back in 30 seconds.
In the series, When Shall These Things Be?, you'll learn that the biblical teaching concerning the rapture, the tribulation, Armageddon, the Antichrist, and the millennium are not necessarily in agreement with the wild sensationalist versions of these doctrines found in popular prophecy teaching and Christian fiction. The lecture series entitled When Shall These Things Be? Can be downloaded without charge from our website, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. You know, I heard a news story just yesterday, that was saying that scientists have proven that thinking really does make your brain hurt. If so, there's an awful lot of people running our country who probably have never had their brains hurt. But if you were listening to the last 5 minutes before the break, probably some of your brains are hurting, because we were going rather rapidly through a lot of stuff that's, frankly, hard to sort through and requires some serious thinking. But we were talking about the book of Revelation and the different views of it. And I just want to remind you, I did write a book years ago. It's still in print. Thomas Nelson publishes it. It's called Revelation Four Views, A Parallel Commentary. And if you don't want to read a big book of 600 pages to get through it, you can always listen for free to my lecture series on Revelation, which is, like all my lecture series, free at thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. If you want to listen to the Revelation series, just go to thenarrowpath.com and click on the tab that says Verse by Verse. There you'll see all the books of the Bible named. Click on Revelation, and those lectures will pop right up. And they're all free to download or to listen to on the website or on the app. All right, let's talk to Robert from Indianapolis. Hi, Robert. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Quick question. Very simple. According to the Bible, what is the moment of creation?
The moment of creation is when God created the heavens and the earth. We don't know what you mean. You want to know what time it was, or what time of day or what year?
No. What you just told me was your answer, which is Genesis chapter 1, verse 1.
Yeah.
I am not in agreement with you. I think it was another time.
What time?
I won't bother you. Genesis chapter 1, verses 3.
Oh, really?
Because God spoke. So, according to the psalmist, God spoke, God commanded the heavens to be. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, he doesn't speak. Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, he does not speak. Genesis chapter 1, verse 3, he does speak. And then, furthermore, verse 3 says, that is the first day. If the Bible says it's the first day, I have to count it as the first day.
Okay. Well, let me answer that just a little bit. You could be right. Genesis 1:1 and 1:2 don't mention God speaking, but it doesn't say he didn't. When it says God created the heavens and the earth, It doesn't say he didn't speak. It just doesn't mention him speaking. But we do know from other passages he created by speaking. And so if he created the heavens and the earth by speaking, then when we read about him creating the heavens and the earth, we would assume, reasonably, that he spoke. Now, there is another way to look at it. But see, the first time he spoke, in Genesis 1:3, he didn't create the heavens and the earth. He created light. On the first day, he spoke and said, "Let there be light." Okay, well, maybe the heavens and the earth came into existence the moment he created light. There's a possibility. Some people think so, because they say the Big Bang would also be the origin of light and of the universe. Well, I mean, if that's how it was, then that's how it was. But technically, we don't read that God spoke to create the heavens and the earth until you get to Psalm 33:6. So anyway, it's not quite stated that the heavens and the earth were created in verse 3, and it's not stated in verse 1 that God didn't speak to create the heavens and the earth. It just doesn't mention it there. But there is an alternative way, certainly, of looking at it, and that is that some people feel that verse 1 of Genesis, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," is not, it's just setting the stage. It's kind of giving a chapter heading. It's basically speaking generically, God created everything. And then after that, when God began to speak, that starts to tell the story of him doing it. It's sort of like some Bibles that the publishers put in a paragraph headings or to kind of summarize what's going on. And it's possible that Moses just started with him, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And I'm going to tell you how it happened." It started out with God speaking and saying, "Let there be light." Now, if that's what Moses is doing, then you're correct. Then your position is correct. And so, of course, I don't care. But, I mean, I don't know why you would either. I don't know why anyone would. But the point is, there's a possibility you're right. But it's also possible that you're not. But it doesn't matter. Thank you, though, for your thoughts. Len from California, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Yes. How are you?
Good, thanks.
So, Steve, I have a question about Catholicism. I have a friend who's a Roman Catholic, and we were having a discussion in the book of John, John 20, and we came across verse 23 with regard to forgiving sins. And so the discussion took on the flavor of, well, the Catholic Church teaches that that a priest forgives sins, and I tried to explain that Jesus is the only one that can forgive sins, and of course she told me that Catholicism goes back to the time of the pre-resurrection when
right.
Jesus
so would you like me to address that verse?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, the verse you're talking about, for those who don't know, is Jesus speaking to the apostles after his resurrection. He's in the upper room with them. He says, "If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven them. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained." Now, what the Roman Catholics believe is that Jesus was giving the apostles special apostolic authority to act in God's place in the forgiveness of sins, to either allow or disallow someone from being forgiven of sins, that this is now delegating to the apostles this authority. Now, the Catholic Church goes further and says that before the apostles died, they appointed others to fill their roles. So when Peter died, someone took his place. When Andrew died, I guess someone took his place. When Paul died, somebody took his place, so that the next generation of leaders were also apostles. They sort of have the apostolic badge. The plaque on the door, that apostle so-and-so, although we don't know most of their names. But the Catholics do have a list of people who they say were successors, at least of Peter, in Rome. And these are what we call bishops of Rome. And there were bishops in many churches. I don't know if anyone has ever tried to list the successors of all 12 apostles, since this is an apostolic thing. It seems like we'd want to know not only who was the successor of Peter, who was the successor of Thaddeus, who was the successor of James the Less, who was the successor of James the son of Zebedee, who died well within the lifetime of the other apostles, and you know, he's beheaded early in the book of Acts in chapter 12, and yet we don't see anyone succeeding him. But the Catholics believe that the bishops of Rome are now in the same role as the apostles, or I should say the bishops of the Roman Church. Of course, the Roman Church governs the whole of the whole Roman Catholic system, and they believe that the bishops of the Roman Catholic Church are in the position with the authority of the apostles. So they believe in something called apostolic succession, that these bishops, through the generations, succeeded one another, from going all the way back to the apostles. And in every generation, whoever was the successor of the previous apostles was now the apostles. So they would say that in the Roman Catholic organization, of course, the Pope, they say, is the successor of Peter, and the other bishops, although there's far more than 11 of them, are somehow the successors of the rest of the 11 apostles. And I'm not really sure how that works. You know, if Peter had an actual successor, one man, and then one man in the next generation, one man in the next, I'm not sure how we now have hundreds of bishops who are successors of 11 men. I'm not sure, you know, how that number got multiplied like that. In any case, they would say the bishops of the Catholic Church have this authority to forgive sins or not. Now, of course, they don't have direct contact with all Roman Catholic parishioners, so they have delegated that authority to the priest, the parish priest. And now the parish priest has that authority to forgive sins or not, and that's why Catholics go to confession, and the priest tells them on what terms they can be absolved. You know, light this many candles, say this many Our Fathers, this many Hail Marys, and, you know, go in peace. Now, this is all, based on an assumption that there were successors to the apostles. The Bible doesn't say there were. Usually to prove that there were, the Catholics will say, well, don't you remember when Judas died, they replaced him. In Acts chapter 1, they replaced him with Matthias. So there you go, apostolic succession. But the difference is that Judas left the faith. He apostatized. he was no longer a true apostle, and he didn't die and leave a gap. He left a vacancy because there was, he was an apostate. And so they replaced him. But we don't read that, like I said, James, the brother of John, he died in Acts 12 and no one replaced him. Why? Because an apostle who died faithful remains an apostle forever. And that's why you see in the New Jerusalem, in Revelation chapter 21, it's got 12 foundation stones. And the 12 foundation stones have the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb on them. So they are still the ones. There's not more. There's still only 12 throughout, apparently, eternity. So I disagree with the Catholic view. Now, what does it mean, then? Well, there's several possibilities. I can't say which one is right because it's an obscure statement made only one place. It is possible that Jesus was giving this authority to the apostles, but that wouldn't translate into the same authority to anyone else in another generation. It is also thought that when Jesus said, whoever sins you forgive are forgiven, whoever sins you retain are retained, that he means by that, now this is what many Protestants would say, that what he means is if they preach the gospel, people's sins will be forgiven. The apostles, by their carrying out their mission to the world, are extending the forgiveness of God to people, and if they don't do that, people will remain unforgiven. And therefore, it's speaking about the urgency of their role as the ones who will extend the forgiveness of God through the preaching of the gospel. That's a fairly common Protestant understanding. And maybe that's what it means. I don't know exactly what it means, but I would say this. There's not anything about the verse or any verses else in the Bible that give any credence to the idea that anyone other than the apostles were given this promise. And there's also no suggestion that when the apostles died, that anyone was a successor in their office. So the Catholic Church is simply based on a whole bunch of assumptions for which there's not the slightest biblical evidence.
Well, that's very helpful. I appreciate that that overview.
Okay, Lynn. God bless you.
Thank you.
Bye now. We have some lines open, and we also have callers we're about to take, but if you'd like to try to get on the show before it's over, The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. I also want to mention before I run out of time today that we have a Zoom call tonight. That's once a month, the first Wednesday of every month, at 7 p.m. Pacific time. If you'd like to join us, it's a Q&A time, just like this. So if you want to be part of that, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and click on the tab that says Announcements, and there you'll find the login information for the Zoom call tonight. We're going to talk next to Paul from Colorado, who called earlier. He has a follow-up. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, Steve, sorry, maybe I didn't make my point, you know, clear, but what I was trying to get across that in that portion of the scripture is he never mentions tongues as being in part. So I believe that regardless of what you believe the perfect is, you can't use that part of the Bible to prove that tongues have ceased, because tongues are not mentioned as being in part.
Yeah, I think you did. I think you actually did make that clear. I don't think you were unclear. And my point is, I'm not defending the view that tongues have ceased. So I mean, that's for someone else to defend, not me. However, I will say this: in Acts or in 1 Corinthians 13:8, Paul says, "Love never fails, but whether there are prophecies, they will fail." Whether there are tongues, they will cease. And whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. And then he says, for we know in part and prophesy in part. He doesn't go so far as say, and we speak in tongues in part. But he's just mentioned those three things as things that will pass away. When that which is perfect is come, you won't have that which is in part anymore. So the fact that he doesn't mention tongues when he makes the second statement may or may not be significant. In my opinion, it doesn't really make a difference, but I'm certainly not trying to say that tongues are in part or that they've been done away. So, yeah, your question, it's not really bringing up anything new, but I appreciate you wanting to make that clear. Oscar from Las Vegas, welcome.
Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Steve. So my question is, when you how do you pray in the spirit or in tongues? Do you just let your tongue let loose and not bother about what you're thinking and or how you're feeling?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I can answer that the way you asked it. You asked about me. How do I do it? I just want to say this. What my experience may or may not be normative biblically. The truth is the Bible doesn't ever tell us how to do it. It just indicates that some people do it. And it says they do it and says they shouldn't do it in the church if there's no interpretation. But it does say that if they do it, they can do it to edify themselves. They can speak to God and to privately in tongues, Paul says. And so he simply, basically, Paul just regulates it. He doesn't actually give how-to instructions. And the reason he doesn't is because the people he was writing to were not lacking in already being involved. And he didn't have to tell them how to do it. He had to tell them when not to do it. So we don't have biblical instructions about how to speak in tongues. Now, I myself have spoken in tongues, and you're asking how I do it. Well, I'm always reluctant to lay out my experience on something that the Bible doesn't teach clearly as if that's normative, because it may or may not be. But I'll answer your question. In my case, I consciously have to do it. In other words, well, most of the time anyway, generally speaking, I'm not just walking down the street and suddenly I just start speaking in tongues. That doesn't generally happen. Generally, it happens when I'm praying, in English, and then at times, and usually it's when I've run out of things to pray in English, I can't think of anything else, then I'll go into praying in tongues. Now, how's that done? Well, it can't be done unless you have the gift, but if you do have the gift, you just start doing it. Now, I'll tell you this. When I got baptized in the Spirit, I expected to speak in tongues, and I didn't. I actually thought something was going to just come over me in an overwhelming way, and suddenly I'm going to just be speaking in tongues. And frankly, that seemingly does happen to some people. I've heard people say that happened to them. And it seems almost like that's probably what happened on the day of Pentecost and in the house of Cornelius. So I'm not going to say that never happens. I kind of expected that to happen, and it didn't. And therefore, I assumed that I didn't have the gift. As I studied it more in the Bible, I realized that that we had control over it. Even if you have the gift, Paul said, listen, if there's no interpreter, just don't do it. Oh, well, you mean I cannot do it even if I have the gift? Yeah, I have control over that. I just like I have control over whether I speak in English or any other action that I do. I can do it or not. Now, if I decide to do it, and if God has given me that gift, then I just have to start speaking. And you ask, do you just not worry about what you're thinking about? Kind of. I mean, I pretty much have to be thinking about God. But Paul said, when I pray in the Spirit, my understanding is unfruitful. So he says, therefore, I'll pray in the Spirit, and I'll pray with the understanding also. I'll also sing in the Spirit, and I'll sing with the understanding also. Now, those statements can be taken two ways. One is that he could be saying, I will pray and sing in my own language, and also make sure that while I'm doing it in my own language, I'm in the Spirit too. So I'm praying in the Spirit and in my own language. But I think that's not what he means, because he says after that, otherwise, he says, if you bless God in the Spirit, how will anyone say amen to what you're saying? Because they won't understand you. So blessing God in the Spirit, Paul seems to use synonymously with in a language that you don't know and the others don't know. So when he says, I will pray in the Spirit and I'll pray in the understanding also, it strikes me that he's making a distinction between those two things. And by the way, I'm not interested in convincing anyone that I'm right about this. This is my experience. You asked about it. I don't worry about thinking of things to pray when I'm speaking in tongues. And it's not like I'm speaking in tongues all the time either. I mean, sometimes more than others. Sometimes I go months without doing it, but then I feel a little bad. I feel like, I may be neglecting something. Paul said, don't neglect the gift of God, which is in you by the laying on of the hands of the presbytery. But stir up the gift, he said. But the fact that it can be neglected, the fact that somebody who has spoken in tongues can not do it for a period of time, indicates that this isn't just something that kind of sweeps over you and overwhelms you and makes it happen. Generally speaking, you're participating, but you're not, I mean, if it's genuine, you're not making up the sounds. You're just speaking out what comes, hopefully from the Spirit. Now, again, I've just told you something that goes far beyond what the Bible says, and nobody's obligated to believe my experience is normative. If someone says, well, Steve, I don't have that experience. Okay, I'm not interested in making anyone have my experience. I'm just talking about what's true of me. And I think it's true of many other people, but maybe not of all. So thanks, Oscar, for your call. Robert from Pinole, California. Welcome.
Yeah, hi, Steve. My question is, we know when a Christian dies, the Bible says to be absent from the body, to be present with the Lord. And at the church I attend, one of the youth pastors recently passed away. And when the pastor was preaching, he said, you've heard it say that, Christians can't look down from heaven. But he goes, but I'm here to tell you that's not true. So he quoted Hebrews 12, verse 1, about the great cloud of witnesses. Yep. So my question is, I don't believe that's true, but what are your thoughts and what does the Bible teach about Christians who have passed looking down here at the people on earth? Because he said that the pastor that passed away, was watching his service, while we were at church on right. Sunday.
Well, I don't think he had solid biblical proof for that. And I don't have a firm opinion as to whether people who've gone to heaven can see us here, but I suspect not. I suspect that once they've gone to heaven, they're done here. And they don't have to worry about what's going on down here. And, I just assume, you know, not imagine that everybody in heaven is watching me take a shower, for example. I mean, I feel like they, you know, they've got other things to focus on, like God, which is, to my mind, much more interesting. But on the other hand, I don't know that the Bible tells us that they can't see us, even if they're present with the Lord. The Lord can see us, so maybe they can too. But I doubt it. Now, the verse he quotes in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 1 is, therefore, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us run the race with diligence. The cloud of witnesses, obviously referring to those people that are enumerated in chapter 11, who were the saints of the Old Testament, the writer of Hebrews indicates that they form a great cloud of witnesses to us. But the question is, what does witness mean? Is he talking about them as spectators? Like somebody is watching you and they're witnessing how you're running the race. Sometimes it's seen that way, that they have finished their race. Now they're in the bleachers watching you finish your race. And the writer does say, therefore, we have this great cloud of witnesses. Let us run the race with diligence. And if he is saying these people have run their race and now they're watching us from the stands as we have our turn, then he would be suggesting that they are watching us. But the word witnesses in the Bible, more often than not, is not referring to someone like a spectator, but is talking about somebody who's like giving testimony, somebody in a court of law who's a witness, giving a testimony, and that they are witnesses to us. That is, their lives, their life of faith testifies to us that God blesses those who live their lives in faith, that this is the right way to go. So in a sense, the word witnesses can be taken one of two ways, but it probably doesn't mean both. And the pastor there, obviously, is assuming that witnesses in Hebrews 12:1 means spectators or people who are watching, whereas it's entirely possible that he's not saying anything about them watching us, but rather that they have run their race and their life testifies to us. It's an inspiration to us all, and it tells us, it speaks to us of, you know, the results of those who have lived by faith and God's blessing and approval upon them. So this is where he's getting that. And honestly, I don't know that there's anything that would tip the scales one way or the other of those two possibilities, which means he's got every right to see it that way. And if you see it the other way, then you've got every right to see it that way. It also means that we can't ever be 100% sure which way the writer of Hebrews meant it, nor, and I've said this several times on subjects today, I don't always say this, but nor does it matter very much. You know, if you think of them as sitting in the stands, cheering you on as you go through the trials of life, and as you're being tested and tempted, and they're watching you and cheering for your victories, well, that might be encouraging. Or not. I mean, maybe they're not doing that. Maybe they are just, their life is a witness to us all, an inspiration to us all, and basically confirms the message that we've heard, that living by faith is the way to go, the way that pleases God and the way that is going to have God's blessing. Anyway, we can't go any further today. The music's playing and I'm going to be off the air here in about 20 seconds. So let me just say The Narrow Path is listener supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website. You can donate from there. It's The Narrow Path. .com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.